You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host from Newark, Delaware, Bill Humphrey.
From 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you this March 18th, 2013 from the University of Delaware. Ahead this hour, I sit down with Dr. Julio Carrion to talk about Hugo Chavez's death. Then I explain the consequences of a seemingly distant banking crisis in Cyprus. And I look at the aftermath of the Kenyan presidential elections. Guest commentator Sasha then joins me to talk about North Dakota's attempted ban on abortions. And I look at the failed federal minimum wage hike and the growing impact of the federal budget sequester. All this is just ahead, right here on Arsenal for Democracy. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Monday afternoon and is available for download on Monday nights at billhumphreyresearch.com/radio and from iTunes and other locations. We air the show locally on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Email us at afdradio@gmail.com or call and leave a message with your views and questions at 347-688-6676. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. My guest this week is Dr. Julio Carrion. He is an associate professor of political science and international relations at the University of Delaware, where he has been specializing in Latin American and comparative politics. His research focus recently has been on mass support for authoritarian alternatives in Latin America. I'm sitting down with him on March 15th to talk about the recent passing of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez after 14 years in power. Dr. Carrion, welcome to Arsenal for Democracy, and thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
As my first question, I would say that President Hugo Chavez was, like many prominent world leaders, a pretty complicated figure. And a lot of the coverage here in the United States of his passing seems to have kind of divided into this polarized good-evil framing. And Chris Hayes on MSNBC recently did a segment where he was pointing that out and saying that that's probably oversimplified for any leader, but it's especially true for someone like President Chavez, who I would argue loomed kind of larger than life in both Venezuela right. and here in the United States and on the world stage in general. So the first question is, what, in your opinion, would be seen as his greatest positive achievement or legacy, and what would be seen as his greatest failing or negative legacy? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So let's start with a positive. I think that he will be remembered as the Latin American president that in recent memory changed the terms of the political debate in the region and set the agenda. Even though beforehand there had been a preoccupation with issues of social inequality and income redistribution, his rhetoric in favor of the poor and his efforts to have regional leadership set him apart from other presidents and to a certain extent change the terms of the debate. I think that will be his most positive legacy. The negative legacy will be associated with how he wanted to actually deal with the issues he identified as issues that were critical for the future of Latin America. And I think the main criticism will be that his social policies might not have been sustainable over the long term, given the way they were designed and the purpose that they were designed for. I think very few people will criticize the content of the policies, the fact that he's providing for education and health and access to food that in previous governments failed to do it. But I think that the criticism was that he did it with a political purpose, and the political purpose was to stay in office for as long as he could and also to undermine the opposition, which by and large is a democratic opposition, even though there are segments in the opposition that are not that democratic. But I think that will be his main criticism. And also that his rhetoric, both towards his domestic opponents and his international opponents, was too harsh and unnecessarily controversial. And to that extent, he failed to build that kind of political alliances that will make his social policies sustainable over the long term.
So, you know, on that note of kind of assessing how did it work out and how will it work out, how successful was the so-called Bolivarian Revolution at achieving its at least stated aims?
Not that much, really, in the sense that Chavez did what many other Latin American governments had been able to do in the last 10 years because of economic growth in general. Poverty has been reducing Venezuela. Income inequality has been reducing Venezuela. Many people left the ranks of the poor, but so did many other Latin American countries. So it wasn't a situation that happened only in Venezuela. It happened in many Latin American countries. And some Latin American countries, such as Chile and Brazil, were much successful than Chavez's regime in reducing poverty and income inequality. Now, so it's a question of whether we want to look at the glass half empty or half full. Yeah, he did accomplish certain goals, but so did other Latin American countries. So the question is to what extent his policies were the cause of those successes, or was more of a regional impact, and the fact that Latin America has been experiencing a significant economic boom for the last 10 years. I mean, the region has grown dramatically, and that economic growth has impacted in levels of poverty and income inequality. So that would be my assessment.
Now, a lot of the criticism from the United States, and you mentioned some of his rhetoric against the opposition, is kind of framing him as a dictator or some, you know, strong man. And you mentioned that he had definitely tried to keep himself in power as a pretty major goal. In terms of how we would characterize it on the ground, was his government democratic? Was it popular but authoritarian? Was it some combination of that? Was the support kind of from the people, was that forced or exaggerated, or was there genuine support for him?
Well, his government wasn't peculiar to the extent that his government is representative of a number of governments in many other Latin American regions that exhibit similar characteristics. First of all, they have an electoral origin. So they come to power initially through free and fair elections. And they are very popular initially. And to a certain extent, they retain a degree of popularity throughout. The criticisms that are valid is that once in power, they change the rules of the games that enable them to get to power. And therefore, they change and undermine democratic institutions with an aim in staying in power. And to a certain extent, they sometimes cross the line. And I do think that in the case of Venezuela, his regime, especially in the last 5 years, crossed the line, and it could not be characterized as a typical democracy. It wasn't a typical dictatorship either. I mean, he was popular. By the time of his passing, he retained more than 50% of popularity approval. He won elections, almost all of them but one. And it's likely that his successor will also win elections 4 weeks from now. But what it is clear is that his political party has full control of all political institutions. There is no surprise when the Supreme Court rules. We know he's going to rule in favor of the ruling party. He has full control of the legislature. And what is more worrisome is that he has attacked independent media in Venezuela, as other governments in Latin America have done from both the left and the right. So that's not, you know, a peculiarity. But I think that in many ways, Chavez resembles another president that I have studied very closely, who is Alberto Fujimori from Peru, even though they have different political persuasions. Alberto Fujimori was a right-wing autocrat. I will characterize Chavez as a more left-wing autocrat. He ruled with no check and balances, and I think that is a disservice not only to democracy but also to the poor, because many of his social programs are likely to be disbanded when his party leave power because they will be associated with the regime. And so the sustainability of the programs are in risk because they are too tight, too tightly associated with the previous regime. Something that we don't see in other countries like Chile, where, for instance, after almost 15 years of socialist rule, the new government, the new president, somebody from the right, did not abolish those programs. In fact, also supported those programs. So I think that's an important factor to consider.
So I guess, you know, and you're mentioning a lot of comparisons here, and of course you do teach comparative politics. That makes sense. One of the things that I know that we've talked about previously on this show with some other professors that we've had on in the past is this kind of idea that in Europe, there's been this convergence toward this sort of center-left, center-right, like shared agreement that within this range, we all support these programs and their sustainability. But partly that's because after World War II, they kind of took away that cult of personality type thing that they didn't associate them with one person. Is the problem then in Latin America going to be that in Venezuela and in some of these other governments that the programs are still too closely associated with one ruler or one party, so that then as soon as the other party comes in, you have to, you know, sweep it from to bottom to dismantle that?
That is exactly the problem in a country like Venezuela and another country like Ecuador. Whereas in other experiences of also left-wing presidencies like Lula in Brazil and Bachelet in Chile, those programs have remained in place after, well, certainly in Brazil they haven't left power yet, but nobody's challenging those programs because the PT, the Labor Party, who is now in its third term and is likely to win a fourth term, has respected the terms of the constitution and the rules of the game. And the opposition, both the social democratic and the right-wing opposition, recognize the legitimacy of the Lula and the PT government. And that was the case also in Chile. In Venezuela, on the other hand, that legitimacy was not acknowledged by the opposition, precisely because in many cases, Chavez use his popularity to undermine democratic institutions. And the most clear or the clearest example of that was the way in which he was able to change the constitution to abolish all term limits after he lost the only election that he ever lost. When people rejected that reform, he came back 1 year later and was able to finally squeezed a favorable vote to abolish term limits. And that obviously runs against all democratic criteria in the Latin American tradition.
Now, how do you think that his passing is likely to affect the pro-Chavez Bolivarian governments in the region, such as in Ecuador or Bolivia?
I think it raises the question of leadership. Maduro, his vice president, and who is running to replace for the presidency, is likely to be elected. I think Chavez retains a lot of support and popularity, and most people will vote for his named successor out of sympathy for Chavez. So Maduro is going to be the next president, I think, and he will try to replace Chavez as a regional leader. But he really lacks the leadership abilities and the personal qualities to fulfill that role. And so he will face a challenge, especially from Rafael Correa in Ecuador, who is a much more charismatic and to a certain extent shares many of the personality attributes that Chavez had, meaning a predilection for confrontation and controversial statements. So I think Venezuela risks leadership in this Bolivarian alliance because of the emergence of new presidents, especially Correa. On the other hand, Venezuela is still a rich country for Latin American terms, right? I mean, it's an oil-producing nation, so they have the power of the purse, so to speak.
Now, how do you think that the relationship is likely to change between some of these governments, such as the Correa government or the new government in Venezuela, with the United States or with Iran or with any of these other countries that they've been having all these major interactions with in the past several years?
Something that newspapers have not really noticed is how Maduro, even when he was acting president, approached the United States to improve relations. And I think that is a decision that has been made. And I think that relations with the United States in a Maduro administration will be better than had been with a Chavez administration. But on the other hand, we should not forget that these are, to a certain extent, rhetorical battles. I mean, in economic terms, the United States is the number one buyer of Venezuelan oil, and that Venezuela's economy pretty much relies on exports to the United States. So neither the United States nor the Venezuela government want a word of words that's going to get into the real issue of economic exchange.
Right. And the former congressman from Massachusetts, Joe Kennedy II, is still, long out of Congress now, still working on getting the Venezuelan oil to the low-income folks in
Boston.
In Boston. Yeah. Right. And I still hear him on the radio talking about the, even as recently as a few weeks ago before Hugo Chavez had passed away, praising him and saying that he, thanks to the generosity of Citgo and the Venezuelan government, people aren't in the cold this winter.
Well, heating oil is very expensive in this country, right?
Right.
And that program has helped many poor neighborhoods in cities like Philadelphia and Boston. So, yeah.
Now, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad from Iran was at the funeral for Hugo Chavez, and they had kind of formed a pretty, at least on the surface, a pretty close relationship that I think probably was cause for concern in the United States and another reason to reject Chavez. Is that something that's likely to continue that relationship, or was that more of a just let's get together and annoy the United States?
Yeah, that's basically it. And Ahmadinejad is on his way out. You know, he's going to be no longer president by the end of this year. There will be a new president in Iran. To what extent that new president will be able to strike the personal relationship with a new Venezuelan president that he had with Chavez is open to question. I don't think it's going to be the same kind of relationship. Iran doesn't have a strategic interest in Latin America. Venezuela doesn't have any strategic interest in the Middle East. It was just a way of, sticking it to the United States.
Now, President Chavez also spent much of his final months and much of his time while he was in office in general in Cuba, but most recently he was there for medical treatment. And he had a really close relationship with Cuba and the Castro government there. Now, Cuba's regime benefited from that relationship as well, certainly, with the largesse coming from Venezuela. And that was especially helpful to them in the present period. Because they no longer have that lifeline that they used to a long time ago from the Soviet Union.
That's right.
How do you think that the passing of President Chavez is going to impact the Castros and the stability or economic security of their government?
Yeah. That's going to be a point of contention in Venezuela, especially within the ruling party, because Maduro is perceived as a Cuban man, as somebody who's very close to the Castros. And the other significant leader from the Chavista regime is Diosdado Cabello, leader of the National Assembly, who is perceived as a man from the military who is not that sympathetic to the Cubans. And that could be a source of contention, because I think Diosdado Cabello will look at the future, basically thinking, okay, after Maduro, whom? Is Maduro going to try to run for re-election as Chavez did, or is there going to be any room for me? Will I ever have the chance to be president of this country? So that's going to create a set of tension, and Cabello can easily use the Cuba issue as a wage issue within the ruling party, because not many people are happy that of the Venezuelan largesse to Cuba, as you put it.
Dr. Julio Carrion is an associate professor of political science and international relations at the University of Delaware, and he's been speaking to us this week on the late President Hugo Chavez of Venezuela. Dr. Carrion, thanks very much for taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you for inviting me.
I'm Bill Humphrey, and this is the Arsenal for Democracy. According to Liz Alderman and Landon Thomas Jr. of the New York Times on March 18th, the European administrators of the proposed Cyprus bank bailout have demanded that the newly elected president of Cyprus impose an unprecedented one-time tax of 6.75% on savings deposits in Cypriot banks as a condition for receiving the bailout. Cyprus is, of course, an island member of the Eurozone, which is the area within the European Union that uses a common currency known as the euro, and they are located in the Mediterranean and are sometimes regarded as a tax haven, basically. And that has been a factor in this, but their banks, like a number of the other banks and central governments of Europe and the Eurozone specifically, have been in deep fiscal crisis for the past several years, and they are now looking to try to receive a bailout. But this special condition, as I said, unprecedented of the tax on savings deposits, is triggering mass discontent in both Cyprus and other vulnerable Eurozone economies like Italy and Spain. And it has sparked a major bank run in Cyprus as ordinary depositors try to withdraw their funds before they can be taxed. Now, the logic here behind this tax is that Cyprus needs to get their fiscal house in order and bear part of the costs of a bailout so that it doesn't fall on the shoulders of German taxpayers like some of the other Eurozone bailouts have in the short term, such as the one to Greece. But I really feel like this is a turning point. The architects of the Eurozone bailout for Cyprus have effectively lost their minds in pursuing these fanatical austerity agendas so favored on the right. Why would it make sense to impose a sudden tax on savings for bank deposits up to 100,000 euros as a condition for the bailout? First of all, that fails to target the ultra-rich Russian and Cypriot and British tax evaders who are allegedly depositing way more than that amount in Cypriot banks and who are the supposed reason for the tax. If you're not going to tax the people who you're claiming are the reason that you need to impose this tax on, then what is the point? And instead, it's focusing on the wrong people. And that brings us to the second point. It's targeting the people who can least afford to have part of their savings disappear suddenly. Cyprus operates like most economies. It's partly driven and probably primarily driven by consumer spending. If you're taking away, say you're someone who had 10,000 euros in the bank in Cyprus, and this tax comes along, you now have 675 fewer euros than you had before, which means that you're not going to be able to spend it later because you don't have it. Now, I suppose you could say, hey, they're not using the money and therefore it's causing economic drag. But that's not really your call to make, especially when you're dealing with people who really can't afford to have that kind of money suddenly taken away from them. These are not millionaires and billionaires. This tax is not being exempted to particular groups of people or income stratas. The article said that even retirees and people on pensions, fixed pensions, would be facing this tax. That money's just not coming back. Now, this brings us to the third point, which is that, and this one I'm a little bit shakier on, but I'm thinking, just logically working through this, if you had an almost 7% tax imposed on savings deposits, and that was just, boom, it happens once, it happens overnight, and like I said, you've now deleted almost 7% of their savings overnight from that account. You just deleted the money right out of their account. That's going to have an equivalent effect to slashing the purchasing power of that individual, kind of like if there were an inflation spike of 6.75% overnight, because I mean, it's not literally inflation, but I think it would have a similar effect to having a sudden burst of inflation like that, because the average consumer there would suddenly have almost 7% less money, which would be similar to having their money go 7% less far than it did the day before when they go to the market and try to buy something. They've now got to decide, with the same amount of money that they had before, you know, what am I going to spend this on today? Now they've got almost 7% less of it, and they still have to make decisions on what they can buy. And it's not like their wages are going up a commensurate amount that's going to allow them to be able to continue making all the purchases that they would have made. So that's going to throw off everyone's individual household purchasing decisions, and that's going to have a really bad effect on the economy there as well. Now, if I'm completely way off because I'm not an economist, you can email afdradio@gmail.com and give me your economic disagreements on that. But that was troubling to me. But the fourth thing that I thought of is that this just doesn't encourage people to go out and spend money to stimulate the economy, which would be kind of one of the arguments, as I mentioned earlier, that I can see them theoretically making. And this hasn't actually been the argument that they've been making, but I could see that you could say, okay, if we've got an economy where we need people to go out and spend more money and we need them to stimulate the economy on their own, you know, what's the way to get people out there to spend their money? Well, you could impose a tax on savings, a one-time tax on savings, and then that would theoretically encourage people to go and take some of that money out of the account and go spend it instead of keeping it in the account to be taxed. But I don't think that's the way that people actually think. This is where some of these theories break down versus what people actually do in terms of their psychology. I think what it really encourages people to do is just run to the nearest bank and withdraw all their money to put it under the mattress so the government can't take it away. And that's what we've been seeing for the past several days in Cyprus. We've seen people just running to even when the banks close, they're going to the ATMs, and the wealthy investors in particular who have all these connections are saying, you know, they're calling their investment people and saying, pull all my money out of this bank and move it to a completely different country. It's the people who can least afford it are getting targeted twice over because they don't have the logistical capability to get their money out in the way that some of the wealthier depositors do. So they're just going to take their money out and say, I'll figure out when I want to spend it, but I'm going to take out all my money now. As an average Cypriot person, I'm going to put it under my mattress or bury it in my backyard or something. I'm not going to keep it in the bank where it's going to get taken away from me for no reason. I mean, this is crazy. This is coming from these more right-wing economists, these proposals. But of course, it's exactly the kind of paranoid fear that a lot of the American right-wingers have had all this time. Oh, the government's going to take away my money and things like that. Like this, this is not coming from the left. This is not confiscatory communist policies. These are right-wing austerity measures. But the fifth thing that is just absolutely puzzling to me and makes me think that these right-wing bailout administrators from Europe have essentially just lost their minds is that why would you do something that causes a bank run in part of your common currency area while you're trying to stabilize that currency? Bank runs inspire mass panic like almost no other action can. The sight of people going, you know, we've seen photographs on the front page of the New York Times today of Cypriots going to their nearest bank while it's even closed and trying to get out their money like it's a wonderful life. This is how you get people to start panicking. You get people in Spain and Italy to start thinking that they're going to be next and that they need to get their money out. And pretty soon you've got people pulling out all their money out of these banks, and then the banks can't provide loans to people, and that starts an economic slowdown, and soon we're spiraling out of control. And it's just not surprising that people would be running to the bank to get their money when it's suddenly being taken away. This just hasn't happened before. There's a very telling line in the article that indicates how revolutionary and shocking this proposal really is. Quote, "But it is one thing to wipe out bond investors and quite another to force a loss on bank depositors, including Cypriot savers who had their deposits insured and, like people all over the world, had the impression that a government-backed savings account was inviolable." Now, to be fair, I understand that Cyprus was probably desperate to collect revenue lost from tax evasion from the rich and middle class alike. That was a problem that Greece also faced. And this probably seems like an attractive place to grab it because the money's just sitting there captive. But this is going to backfire horribly by inspiring panic, inspiring people to run to the nearest bank and pull out all of their savings because they put the money in there and they expect it not to be touched and they expect it to be available and at the amount that they put in minimum when they go back to get it later. Not really a surprise to see in this article also a mention of the hand of the conservative American Enterprise Institute think tank behind this all the way from Washington. They're vociferously arguing and have been arguing that these banks should be getting their depositors taxed as well. And this is exactly the type of shock doctrine tactics that the political left has been predicting would be applied experimentally in these fiscal crises, particularly in the smaller countries. The New York Times quotes several average Cypriots saying that they believe that they are being targeted explicitly as an experiment because they are in a small country which has a relatively small economy, and that means that they can be the guinea pigs for a larger effort across Europe to employ such tactics. That's the kind of stuff that the American Enterprise Institute's been pushing, and that's the kind of stuff that some of these other bailout architects have been pushing. So the risk is very real that this policy, if enacted in Cyprus, starts spreading everywhere else. And it's just a terrible idea. And the bailout administrators and the backers of the deposits tax are indeed already saying that it should be cross-applied elsewhere if it works here, assuming that it works in Cyprus. And that's totally illogical and unfair. Depositors aren't investors in their banks at all. Their interest on ordinary savings deposits is intended to compensate for inflation, not to make money. They're not making money off of putting their money in the banks. There's no reason that they should be liable for any bad decisions undertaken by their banks. The bank is essentially holding on to their savings for them so they don't have to keep it under the mattress. They're not managing it like an investment bank or a hedge fund and growing the wealth or anything like that. These are average people taking their money, putting it into a bank in Cyprus, and saying, I'll come back for this later, and I know that when I put my 10 or 20,000 euros in the bank, that when I come back, I will get at least 10 or 20,000 euros, whatever I put in at the beginning, I will get at least that much back, and anything else on top of that will just be nominal interest to keep pace with inflation. They're not trying to make a huge return on investment. There's no investment happening. It's literally just hold on to my money for me while I go do something else so I don't have to keep it under the mattress. And now you're saying to these people, oh, I'm sorry, we're actually going to take almost 7% of that away because your bank made some stupid decisions and we're trying to stabilize the currency and we don't want to be on the hook for that. Again, I could go into much greater detail, I won't, about my opinions on why is Cyprus even in the Eurozone to begin with. But, you know, at this point, that's kind of a moot point. Because they are, and they need to deal with that fact, but there's good ways to deal with that fact, and there's bad ways to deal with that fact, and causing a bank run seems like a pretty bad way of doing that, and it's just completely unfair, and it doesn't make sense. There's no, you know, why is it that the people who caused these crises in the United States on Wall Street, in Europe, in the Eurozone, with these various banks, you know, Goldman Sachs manipulating the Greek budgets and things like that, a lot of these people are not being held to account for their part in causing the credit crunch in 2007, the housing collapse in 2007, these Euro underwriter crises happening from 2007 to present. They're not the ones being punished by and large. The people who are being punished now are the average people who had nothing to do with it. So they're probably getting dinged as taxpayers just from other taxes, and now they're getting dinged on their savings deposits because it just so happens that the banks that they put their money into made some spectacularly bad decisions. But again, they didn't invest in those banks. They just asked the bank to hold on to the money for them. If the bank made poor investments, the depositors should be the last ones on the hook, not the ones paying for the bailout. And I think that even though this is just happening in Cyprus right now, and that it's, you know, one small island in the Mediterranean far away from us, and it seems like it doesn't have a connection, I think we need to be very wary, especially if they're already talking about applying this to banks in other countries in the Eurozone. We need to keep an eye on this situation because it is very troubling that they're able to be proposing ridiculous things like this that don't even make economic sense, that have completely divorced any linkage between the consequences, who's getting punished, and who actually did the crime. So even though this is happening in Cyprus, which seems like it's far away and removed from us, we do need to be paying attention to these situations as they do end up having an effect on us ultimately at the end of the line. Kenya's recent presidential elections continue to be disputed following the very narrow win by one of the tickets, and the opponent has been contesting it. Essentially, what happened here was that in 2007, there were highly disputed and very questionable elections. Both sides, international observers said, had conducted extreme levels of fraud. And unfortunately, the way that election had broken down was along ethnic lines, which was something that had not previously happened in Kenya. And the candidates were explicitly campaigning either for one particular ethnicity or sort of in a coalition of other ethnic groups against that ethnic group. And the result of this was that once there it became clear that the election had been conducted fraudulently by both sides, and that it had been done along ethnic lines, this turned into an ethnic clash. And quite a few people were killed. This was very disturbing because Kenya had not previously had this kind of thing happen, and a lot of Kenyans were kind of horrified that this had happened. So they took a lot of steps after finally resolving the situation peacefully and coming up with a compromise government. And they said, let's come up with a new constitution, a new electoral system to try to prevent this from happening. So the way that it was going to work was that you had to have 50% across the country, over 50% across the country to win, but you also had to get at least 25% of the vote in half of the counties, which was the subdivision that they use in the country, like states, across the 47 counties. You had to get at least 25% in half of those counties. And the idea there was that because the ethnic groups tended to be concentrated, you couldn't just win by appealing to a particular ethnic group. Now, the prime minister, through the power-sharing agreement, Raila Odinga, was the losing or allegedly losing candidate in the 2007 elections. He was contesting again the presidential election this time. And from the other main ethnic group that had been backing the alleged winner of last time's election, the deputy prime minister under the power-sharing agreement was running, and his name is Uhuru Kenyatta, and he's the son of the sort of founding father figure of Kenya. And he has been charged by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity for his part in ordering death squad activities following the election during the ethnic clashes. But the interesting thing there was that he brought on as his running mate this guy this other guy, William Ruto, as his running mate. And Ruto is actually from a different ethnic group that was opposed to the ethnic group that Kenyatta is representing during the 2007 election. And Ruto has also been charged by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity, also for ordering death squads, but in the opposite direction. So they're pitching this theoretically as that they had come up with this sort of national unity, ethnic unity ticket. But really, it had a number of practical advantages for them, especially as the sort of front-running candidacy going into the first round of the election. First of all, it does help with the ethnic diversity requirements of getting a stronger power base that's outside just one or two geographical areas, that it's going to help spread their appeal across a broader segment of the country. But the other thing, and this has been alleged by a lot of critics and Western journalists, is that they basically got together in hopes that if they won the election, they could fend off International Criminal Court prosecution. Either live together or we die alone. And if they hadn't banded together, it was going to hurt their chances of having them both get into office. And if they were both out of power or one of them was out of power, it increased the likelihood that one or both of them ended up getting extradited to the International Criminal Court for charges based on the 2007 election. So we had a few weeks ago the first round of the election. And again, need to get 50% to win, but you also need to get at least 25% of the vote across half the counties in the country. So this Kenyatta Ruto ticket, the crimes against humanity ticket, ends up coming out of this election with 50.07% of the vote nationally and just enough in the various counties necessary to win the county ethnic diversity requirement. Now, Raila Odinga immediately starts challenging this. He and his CORD coalition, C-O-R-D, they start challenging the results. And you go, okay, well, is this sore loserism, which is what a lot of people were saying. And a lot of Kenyans were kind of just like, look, we had a peaceful and smooth election. There weren't widespread allegations of fraud in the immediate aftermath. Let's just calm down and accept this result, even with some imperfections, and say, let's just move on with our lives so we don't have a repeat of what happened in 2007. So again, some people are saying, oh, okay, he's just being a sore loser. But 50.07% of the vote, that's a pretty small vote. In the United States, that would probably be triggering recall elections in most states, or recounts of the elections in most states. And then I was reading an interesting Al Jazeera article by Peter Grest, published on March 15th, that was saying, if you look very closely at the elections, as Cord did, now, Cord is alleging that there was some sort of widespread fraud or something rather than miscounting. But at minimum, the data seems to indicate that there was some miscounting or misreporting on a semi-widespread basis in many areas of the country, as well as a massive technical failure by the computing system that they were using. And this indicates that it could, and because it was close enough, this indicates that the election results, while deemed generally clean, free, and fair, could have gone the other way, sort of like the ballot counting issues in Florida in the United States election in 2000. Saying that this wasn't necessarily an attempt to perpetrate a fraud. This is what the Al Jazeera author was saying. It's not necessarily a conscious attempt to perpetrate a fraud, but there may have been a fraud in the results or an accident in the results that has the wrong person winning, or at least is going to trigger a second round. Now, again, Odinga's party is saying, Prime Minister Odinga's party is saying this is an actual fraud, this was done to him, etc., and that is where a lot of the sore loserism charges are coming in and still being retained. But the other interesting thing here is that a lot of Kenyans are saying, look, we got through this election, we have a winner, everyone seems to be pretty much okay with it, even if their guy didn't win. Let's just be done with it, not have a very expensive second round election or a redo election or something like that. Let's just move on. It's not like, you know, it's not like this was 50-50 or something like that. Odinga was the second place winner, but he wasn't, you know, there were other candidates in the first round. Whereas it seems pretty likely that in the second round, Kenyatta's still going to come out as the winner by a larger margin because he won the first round and a lot of the other groups are going, candidates are going to throw their support behind him, especially as the likely expected winner. So at this point, even though it was an imperfect election, it went pretty well. There was a lot of security involved in making it go off smoothly, and it seems like they may end up just proceeding with this. And the international community may end up pressuring the losing candidate, Prime Minister Odinga, to drop his complaints and just accept that he lost. He may have won the last election, but international observers said it was impossible to tell because both sides were effectively cheating on a wide level. And this time, it seems like he may, you know, the margins may be unclear, but he probably didn't win. He certainly didn't win 50% of the vote. And it seems likely that Kenyatta is going to be the winner either way. Probably unfortunate to have a guy charged for international criminal court crimes against humanity in power. But it is what it is. And you know, I think some people are arguing that if this is what it took to bring the nation together, repair the wounds from 2007, heal the fractures, and prevent something like that from happening again, then it is what it is. And let's just accept that there's been an internal reconciliation process. Arsenal for Democracy, we'll be right back after this. I'm Bill Humphrey, and this is Arsenal for Democracy. Joining me this week, as almost always, is my guest commentator, Sasha, who's going to be talking about the latest on the women's fronts and particularly reproductive freedom. Sasha, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Okay, so as you expressed to me before the show, you do feel like you're starting to sound like a bit of a broken record, but that's no fault of yours or mine. That's just the fact that the news keeps coming and keeps repeating itself and keeps getting worse on this particular front. What do you have for us in unfortunate news this week?
So this is, again, coming from a Think Progress article, but it turns out North Dakota is kind of racing Arkansas to see who can be more anti-abortion. So North Dakota this week poised to enact a 6-week abortion ban, which is going to be the most restrictive in the nation if it goes through, and it looks like it probably will.
The legislature's already passed it, and the governor is a pro-life Republican, and they had a veto-proof majority that passed it, so it's pretty much guaranteed to go through.
Right, pretty much guaranteed. So basically, I think the worst before was 12 weeks. This will reduce it to 6 weeks, which is pretty much like that's usually when people are finding out they're pregnant. It really kind of like completely blocks off any opportunity you would have to even get an abortion. And again, kind of defies the Roe versus Wade legal abortion services, which guarantees it around to 24 weeks.
Yeah, well, specifically, yeah, 23 to 24 weeks was the limit that Justice O'Connor had set in the amendment to the amendment to Roe v. Wade, the 1993 Casey v. Planned Parenthood of Pennsylvania decision. But yeah, so this is dropping it from 23 weeks down to 6 weeks, which is almost certainly unconstitutional.
Definitely unconstitutional. It also will have like repercussions. It'll have unintended consequences because you can't. They're basically going off the fetal heartbeat, and you can't detect that early without having a transvaginal ultrasound. So kind of enforces that upon people too.
Once again, yeah, and this is what we've been talking about on previous shows. This idea that since they figured out that they can't ban it outright, they're kind of walking right up to that line and seeing like what artificial scenarios they can create that either mandates a transvaginal ultrasound or prohibits abortion with the most restrictive invented scenarios possible. Like you said, 6 weeks. That's a pretty arbitrary timeline to set. Not really scientifically grounded particularly, but it is probably the closest that you could get that would eliminate pretty much all abortions without banning it outright. Because, as you said, 6 weeks is a little over a month. If you weren't trying for it you're not expecting it, you might not realize that you're pregnant until after 6 weeks, at which point it would be banned in North Dakota.
That said, North Dakota only has one abortion clinic left, and pretty much they're basically trying to close it down as it is. Absolutely.
And there was an interesting post on the MinotDailyNews.com, which is one of the local newspapers in North Dakota, on one of their blogs, Andrea Johnson saying that this is particularly ridiculous because it's just immediately going to go into endless legal challenges that are going to cost the state a lot of money. And it's very puzzling that all these alleged fiscal conservatives, don't want to spend money on anything. Crumbling roads, anything like that. But as soon as it comes to abortion, they're willing to just, hand over fist, get rid of all this money. And who knows what the court decisions are ultimately going to be. But in the short term, there's going to be a lot of injunctions and Casey-based and Roe-based overturning of this at the lower levels. And, it's going to keep progressing and keep costing the state a tremendous amount of money.
It's just one of those things, again, where they're focusing on things that it's just going to cause more problems as far as I'm concerned. More people are going to go to have dangerous, quote unquote, backroom abortion procedures. There's going to be like more of that sort of thing going on. And just the way that people are trying to restrict funding towards Planned Parenthood and all these sorts of ways for women to access contraceptives, they're just making it harder and harder. And they're not, the results are not going to be what I think they want. So it's what they think they want.
And it's particularly interesting, too, coming in the midst of the Republican National Committee today releasing a report of how they think they're going to get back on top in the United States, recapture Congress, recapture the White House, regain their preeminence within the Republican Party specifically. And they have all these things of, improved outreach to youth voters, improved outreach to minority voters, improved outreach to the, lower income strata, improved outreach to women. And as everyone's just pointing out, the document today is ridiculous when you consider it against stuff like this, where it's obviously there's this huge gap between the rhetoric that they're proposing and the actual policy consequences. And women are not stupid, and they can figure out these connections as easily as anyone else can.
It's
so.
Like when the personhood amendment went up for a referendum. Was it Missouri?
I think it was Mississippi.
Mississippi, and it didn't pass because it was
Mississippi, and it was a special election, which is, everything you need to have a Republican conservative wave, and it still got defeated there, and they just don't get it.
That's telling something, and so I hope it's going to backfire. I hope that people realize that this is ridiculous, and I hope it goes to the courts and there's something needs to happen so that this stops. You know what I mean? Like, we can't keep, like, every week I get back on here and I'm like, well, another state decided to do such and such to stop women from having abortions.
Yeah,
and so I think it's just, there needs to be something bigger in order to stop it, because apparently the Supreme Court isn't enough.
At this point, you're just hoping that I never have to ask you back on the show again because everything's peachy, right?
That's a life goal, but I'll see you next week, you know?
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me, as always, Sasha.
Thanks again, Bill.
Continuing now to other domestic news. Last week on Arsenal for Democracy, I talked about how the House Democratic minority under former Speaker Nancy Pelosi, now Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi, had proposed raising the federal minimum wage from $7.25 an hour to $10.10 an hour by 2015 to keep pace with rising inflation. The last time that it was raised was under the Bush administration. And the unfortunate news now is that on Friday, the House Republicans unanimously and joined by a few Democrats voted down an increase to the federal minimum wage that was proposed as basically an amendment to another piece of legislation called the Skills Act, which involved a jobs retraining program. And the Democrats were unable to attach the amendment. This follows in line with Speaker Boehner's refusal in the after the 2012 State of the Union address to back President Obama's proposal to raise the minimum wage to $9. And he's again arguing that it would drive up unemployment because it would make it harder for small businesses to hire. This was reported by Sahil Kapoor of the TPM LiveWire, Talking Points Memo LiveWire, on Friday, March 15th. You can listen. Last week, I went into quite a bit of detail arguing why it was necessary and important to raise the minimum wage so that people can, you know, who are the working classes, really not making a ton of money, can actually, make enough money to get by and buy some of the necessities that they need, and then hopefully start buying some other things that will help stimulate the economy. And right now they really can't do that because they're paid pretty low, and it's just not keeping pace with inflation, which is why Pelosi was proposing this increase. As I said last week, it was kind of not too likely that it was going to get passed, but I was hoping that it would, given that it had passed under the Republicans before during the Bush administration. But we'll have to see if we can try again and get it passed at some point in the near future. Meanwhile, the federal budget sequester continues to have a pretty deleterious effect on quite a few policies, particularly those programs that help those people who are low income folks and the people who really depend on a lot of these programs, you know, just to get basic services and help their kids every day. For example, Think Progress gathered articles from the Indiana Journal-Gazette, the Claiborne Progress in Tennessee, KREM in Washington, the Pennsylvania Daily Review in Pennsylvania, and the Palm Beach Post in Florida. These were all stories from just a mix of states where Head Start programs that are partly state-funded, partly federally funded, that they are having to cut these programs, kick kids out of the programs. Basically, for those who don't know, Head Start is the way that low-income kids get to go to pre-kindergarten programs and other preschool programs, which helps them to get situated, get their skills up to speed on just the basics before they go to kindergarten, start learning those skills of dealing with other kids at school, things like that. But it also really helps parents a lot, because those low-income parents have to make tough choices between going to various jobs, especially if they're working multiple jobs, and being home with their kids and providing those critical early development skills like talking to your kids a lot, reading to your kids a lot, things like that, that many of those parents would probably love to do, but the simple reality is that they can't be home because they have to work those extra jobs just to put food on the table for their kids. This provides a safe environment for those kids to be at during the day before they're in elementary school, and it provides a richer, more intellectually stimulating environment that helps them be more prepared and better adjusted for going to elementary school. And 70,000 students across the nation will lose the opportunity to be in the program, according to this Think Press article by Annie Rose Strasser on March 15th. Because of the federal reductions in funding across the board for many of these programs. Of course, a different Think Progress article kind of reported on the fascinating and disturbing trend in the media of basically focusing on really, really superficial things like the White House tours being eliminated and stuff like that as a consequence of the sequester. That's a very minimal consequence of the sequester. Really, I'm not that sad if you weren't able to go on a White House tour, and I don't think anyone should. But to give you a scale of how ridiculous this has gotten, that they, you know, versus focusing on actual programs like cuts to Head Start, Ari Melber of The Nation. Wrote a piece last week where he was calculating these differences and found that across all forms of media in the United States, there were 12,000 news stories about the White House tours being eliminated or reduced, and there were fewer than 1,000 articles or TV hits or radio segments about the sequester's impact on things like housing assistance programs for low-income Americans or various other things. This obsessive focus, particularly on cable news, according to Think Progress's number crunching, Fox News, CNN, and MSNBC since March 6th mentioned White House tours 33 times more often than any other sequester impacts that would hit the poor. Programs like Head Start, like the housing assistance programs. Fox News had 163 segments about the sequester impact on the White House tour. CNN did 59. MSNBC had 42. And that was between March 6th and March 13th, I believe. Or March 14th, rather. And that is just insane to me. Like, I don't understand how people could possibly care that much about that and not be caring about these actual programs that affect real, ordinary people. That's what matters, not the White House tours. And the White House is even caving on that and will probably end up refunding the White House tours because it's gotten such a backlash. Like, I'm sorry, we don't live in some world of the West Wing with Martin Sheen and company, okay? This is the real world. We should be focusing on these other programs that have very serious impacts. Well, that's all for this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy for March 18th, 2013. There will be no show next week as I will be on vacation. The show is usually recorded at the University of Delaware Perkins Center every Monday and is available for download from billhumphreyresearch.com/radio on Monday nights. You can also hear a repeat of it on 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark or at WVUD.org every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man Justin and my guest commentator Sasha. My guest expert this week was Dr. Julio Carrion of the University of Delaware International Relations Department. From the WVUD studios in Newark, Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.